Yes, you didn't have to be a Levite to be a Pharisee, if that's what you mean. And not every Levite would have been a Pharisee. So, yeah, I mean, there could have been overlap. They're not separate groups, but they're not synonymous. Anyone else who might have been feeling smug? The disciples? Well, let's start with the disciples. Why might the disciples have been feeling smug after hearing how Jesus criticized the Pharisees?
Because the Pharisees criticized Jesus over his disciples. So now they could say, give it to him, Jesus.
Yeah, all right.
And thinking about the publicans?
Well, tell me more.
Well, the tax collectors, what the Pharisees called the sinners.
All right. The sinners might have been feeling smug. In fact, down just a little bit after this section, if you read the beginning of chapter 15, it says the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear him. So they're certainly present. And anybody else? Yeah. In fact, we're told there's a large crowd of people. Anybody who didn't identify themselves with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law might have been feeling smug. And there's a large crowd of them standing outside. And when the word gets out, you should have heard what Jesus said to those Pharisees. Here's this large crowd of people standing out there. Jesus comes out from the meal and immediately addresses this large crowd of people who may have been starting to feel a little bit smug. In fact, if the story of the banquet got out, what's the message in that story? The Pharisees. Yeah, everybody is welcome. But those who came were the poor, the humble, the people who live on the street. Well, here's this large crowd of people. And what does it say they're doing? Yeah, they're following Jesus around wherever he goes. Well, Jesus was essentially homeless. Here's the homeless crowd outside going, hey, we overheard some of that story. We're on the inside, and those Pharisees are on the inside. They couldn't tear themselves away from all their money and houses to come to the party. But we've dropped everything. We didn't have anything going on at home anyway. I mean, there's no point in me going home. There's no jobs there. I haven't got any food in the house. I'm going to hang around Jesus. My only hope is that he's the Messiah, and he's going to turn everything upside down and make us wealthy and powerful and give those Pharisees what they deserve. And so they're feeling pretty good. We came out on the right side in the story. But Jesus addresses them with some very interesting words. Now, just on the surface, you heard Jesus' comments to them. Maybe we should have someone read them again. Have a volunteer to read Jesus' words starting in verse 26, just 26 and 27. Just on the surface, how do his comments strike you emotionally? If you'd been there in the crowd, is this a pep talk or a put off?
A serious warning.
Whoa! This is not the typical sermon that you heard Jesus preaching, right? He says, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, and hate your family. Pardon? Yeah, and if you hate them, if you get angry with somebody, you'll be liable to the same judgment as if you had murdered someone. A bit shocking. A bit of a put-off, right? These people have been following Jesus. They were enamored with everything he said. They loved it when he criticized the Pharisees. But now he says to them, can't follow me unless you hate your family. What? That would be unnatural. Well, Jesus asked people to do all kinds of unnatural things. But it goes against What, if I hate my family and I treat them really nasty and I abuse them and they become my enemies and they come after me, I have to love my enemies. Something is not quite right with this picture. Well, what do we do with that? Shall we keep reading and see if it makes any more sense? He says, anyone who does not hate his family cannot be my disciple. But he also says, anyone who does not hate even his own life cannot be my disciple. Well, does that mean we should be suicidal? I hate living. I think I'll go jump off a bridge. I think this microphone is going bye-bye. Should I replace the battery? Pardon? I think it's going, but we'll see if that cures it. So, shall we all be suicidal? Like, what was that cult that thought when Halley's Comet came nearby that if they all committed suicide at just the right time that they would be picked up, that it was a spacecraft?
The Hale-Bopp.
Yeah. Is that what Jesus is advocating? Hate your life. Yeah, although I'm not sure exactly that they were even thinking they were committing suicide. I don't know the whole story on that, but at least some of them didn't know what was going on. Yeah, is that what Jesus is advocating? We use that, I don't know how many of you have heard kids use the expression, he was hating life. Anybody heard that? It just means you're having a rough time, that you'd rather not be having your life right now. It's like the other expression, well, I'd hate to be you, to be hating life. Is that what Jesus wants people to be doing, to be having such a horrible time that they are hating life? Well, if that doesn't quite make sense, then what about the next part? And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple? I've got it. In order to be disciples of Jesus and good Christian people, we've all got to go out and get a big splintery beam, put it on our backs, and carry it around with us wherever we go. Because, right, we're following Jesus every day, aren't we? So anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. Volunteers? Got some railroad ties at home? Well, why is it that we have no trouble figuring that this is figurative? Pick up his cross and follow me. We know that's figurative language. But we get all caught when he says, hate your father and mother and brother and sister. Maybe some of us really want to hate our fathers and mothers. Well, maybe not. Maybe if we hated our family, we'd feel better about ourselves. I can be a good disciple of Jesus, even though I hate my family. Well, if Jesus clearly is using figurative language when he says, take up your cross and follow me in order to be my disciple, then perhaps also that is an insight into the other things. Maybe it is at least at some level figurative when he says, hate your life or hate your family.
Well, but
go ahead.
The correlation in Matthew says, he who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me.
And typically, that's what we say. We say, well, Jesus doesn't mean you really have to hate them. He just means you can't love them more than you love Jesus. And the reality is, that seems to be perfectly accurate. That's what he's getting at. It's not that he wants you to be antisocial and become mean and nasty to your family and kick them out on the street or starve them or beat them. What he's saying is, if you follow me, one of these days, you may have your child or your wife or your parents say to you, well, you just hate me. As a direct result of following Jesus. Well, if you loved me, and in essence he's saying, could you stand to be separated from the people who are nearest and dearest to you in order to follow me. Okay? And he says, if. It's a choice. You don't have to follow me. But if anybody wants to follow me, you get to decide. Is it worth it to you to follow me if it means you are separated from all the people who are nearest and dearest to you on this earth? How many of you have had to make that decision? Some have encountered that decision. I had a professor at seminary who is from Nineveh in modern Iraq. That's where he grew up. Pardon?
Go ahead.
His family was not Muslim, however. They were Orthodox Christians. But culturally, things are not a whole lot different between Orthodox Christians in that part of the world and Muslims in this one aspect. We have a Seventh-day Adventist church there in Nineveh, and although they are forbidden to do much public proselytizing, now, they can't hold evangelistic meetings and put ads in the paper and so on, but they can't hold meetings in the church. And they had put a sign up on the front of the church and had a special meeting. And this fellow happened to walk by, got interested, and went into the meeting. And as a result of that, he became a Seventh-day Adventist Christian. And he was literally beaten out of his family. They beat him up and kicked him out and told him never to come back. Whose choice was it that happened to him?
Yeah,
now, I realize that's a trick question, but...
He allowed it, but the family members were the ones that drove him out.
The family members were the ones that chose to do that to him, but he could have stopped it if he had said, "Never mind, I'll be Orthodox." And so it was his choice to follow Jesus. Now, I'm not absolving the family of responsibility. I don't want you to misunderstand that. You understand what I mean. It was their choice to do it. But he got to make a decision. Am I going to let this happen to me? Am I going to follow Jesus, even if it means this or not? And he decided that it was worth it to him to follow Jesus, even if he was separated from his family, beaten, thrown out on the street. Many, if not most of us, have never had to face that decision. And we hope that we never will have to face that decision in so many words. What about hating your life? If just Jesus doesn't mean being suicidal, same is true. It is possible that if you follow Jesus, someone may threaten you with death. You might be killed for following him. Or you may even have people say to you, "You're throwing your life away. What's wrong with you?" Over in Surprise Valley, somebody mentioned a fellow who's now an Adventist pastor, gave up an $800,000 music contract when he became a Christian. He's a professional musician. Now, I don't know if anybody used that language and "you're throwing your life away." Everything that he could have become out there in the world, wealthy and famous, that people admire. So it's not that Jesus wants people to become suicidal, but he's asking the question, is it worth it to you to follow me, even if it means losing your own life? Is it worth it to you? Could you stand being separated from your own life like being separated from those nearest and dearest to you in order to be my disciple? Carry your cross and follow him. Obviously, he doesn't literally mean go out and find a splintery beam. And anybody who's my follower will be recognized instantly as they're dragging a massive cross through the streets. What is the cross? What is a cross for? What would it mean to carry your cross and follow him? They didn't have a concept of that, but crucifixion was a common method of execution. And the fact that we remember Jesus' crucifixion as this really unique event is our looking back at it. Crucifixions happened around them all the time. The Romans were very fond of that. I don't know if you may not have been here when we preached about or when I preached about slavery and some of the references to it in Ephesians, but Roman society was a slave society, and there was a elite group of people who held most of the land and most of the wealth, and then a vast group of people who were either enslaved or in poverty. And when you have the majority with nothing and a few with something, the only way to maintain that inequity is through some pretty serious brutality and keeping people in fear that this is what will happen to you if you try to break out of this inferior-superior role. And so crucifixion was commonly used by the Romans to maintain their power over the people they'd subjugated, and even used by slave masters to maintain power over their slaves. So people would have understood the imagery of it, even though, you're correct, they didn't have a clue yet what it meant in Jesus' own experience. So what was the cross for? What would it mean to take up your cross and follow? Yeah, it was a symbol of death, and in fact, a particularly painful, humiliating, undignified form of death. It was torture on top of death. Well, if we link it with the other things that Jesus has said here, we certainly get that kind of a picture. He's saying, don't love your own life. Don't be too tied even to your own family. So to take up your cross and follow him would, in one way, mean to be on your way to your own humiliating execution every day. To figure, I'm dead, as you live out each day. And you know, there's incredible power in figuring that you're dead anyway. Incredible acts of heroism and bravery have been done by people who figured, well, I'm probably not going to make it back from this, so I'm going to do the best I can do. Desmond Doss. What chance did he have of surviving the firestorm that he went through? You know, all of the soldiers who went out there at some level, if they were going to function at all, had to figure, well, here goes nothing, you know. I don't have a whole lot of hope that I'm going to make it back from this. And yet, incredible 70-some people, whatever, that he let down from the cliffside, basically figuring, well, I'll go back after another one. God has preserved me this far, but I basically figure I'm dead. So it doesn't hurt to go back for another one. In prisons, the death row inmates stand aloof from much of the prison politics that goes on. You understand that if you end up in a large prison, that you are going to be pressured by the social system of that prison to either join a gang, or you will be beaten to a pulp, or maybe killed. Right? That's what happens inside of a prison. If you don't join a gang, you will keep getting beaten up by various gangs until you do, basically. So for your own protection, for their own protection, inmates will join a gang just so they don't get beat up by all the other gangs. But it's this incredible social pressure to join up and sort of take sides in what ends up being a very conflict-ridden social environment. But I understand, and I don't know how true this is across the board, but that generally speaking, the death row inmates don't have to get into that. Why do you suppose that is?
We have nothing to lose.
Yeah. You can't threaten me with death. I'm not leaving here anyway. Alive. And so they don't have they're not like the other prisoners who are hoping to get out again someday. But they figure, I'm on my way to my own execution. There's incredible power in that kind of an experience. To do what is right, if you can frame your experience that way. Karina's dad often jokes that he figures he's a minister, and he's been in a couple of churches where the church board decided that they really would rather have somebody else. And although it doesn't work that way in the Adventist system, you know, the church board can't hire or fire a pastor. It's still a pretty traumatic experience to have that happen. And so he jokes, I just figure that I'm fired already. And then I can carry out my ministry the way I think God really wants me. I work for God instead of for people. And that's the same sort of picture here. Jesus says, figure that you're dead already, every day. And then you can follow me and not care what other people think about you. Reminds me of how the Hebrews, when they were threatened with the fiery furnace, they knew they were going in. But they could tell Nebuchadnezzar the truth and speak words to him that most people would never have said to the most powerful man in the world, because they figured, well, he's going to execute us anyway. God can preserve us. If God goes ahead and does that, there's nothing he can do about it. But there's nothing we can do about it either. So we can do what's right. And we can speak boldly the truth, even in this situation. Wow. Pretty intense words still. Even though we understand Jesus doesn't really want us to be antisocial toward our family, it's still pretty intense for him to say, if you're going to follow me, you need to decide now, is it worth it to you if you lose everyone and everything that is dear to you, and perhaps even your own dignity? You may die a humiliating, painful, tortured death if you follow me. Jesus is saying, essentially, following me is not going to be easy. Sounds to me like an awful lot of bad news. So what is Jesus trying to do? I mean, here's this whole big crowd of people that are excited to be following him around. How many of you think he's trying to discourage them from following him? I mean, doesn't that sound like it? Are you sure you want to do this? But how many think, you can vote, how many think he's trying to discourage people from following him? I don't see any. How many think he's not trying to discourage people from following him? All right, so this is a bit of a confusing message. You know, I mean, usually when you say to your child, I don't know if I'd do that if I were you, I'd think twice, but be sure you can afford it before you. We're usually trying to discourage them. But you're telling me that even though these are discouraging words, in some sense, that Jesus is not trying to discourage them from following him. Ken?
He's telling them up front, it's going to be tough. It's going to be hard. It's no cakewalk.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better that he tell them up front than them to think, you know, this is a merry little path I have. And then when something happens, they freak out and turn their back and run back to the muck that they came out of.
In fact, even though Jesus has told them up front, isn't that exactly what happens to his disciples?
Yeah.
They freak out when they see all of these horrible things beginning to happen. Although, if we watch them later on, it's startling to see, but they say, wow, it's an honor. If I could be crucified for Christ's sake. Wow. So, there is another implied message in here. Besides, I think twice before I do that. He's warning them, but what does Jesus think is the appropriate decision to make? Yes. So his implied message is not just, this is going to be hard, this is going to be painful, this is going to be difficult. It is also, this is going to be worth it. Mm-hmm. And you really have to respect somebody, I'll catch you in a second, you really have to respect somebody who can say up front, this is going to be the hardest thing you've ever done. But I think it's worth it. Jesus is saying, I think I'm worth it. To be with me will outweigh anything you give up. That's one of the messages that's implied in here. Go ahead, Norm.
They saw a lot of good things.
Yes, they did.
And so they thought, well, this is a cakewalk.
And what were they hoping for? I mean, their lives were trashed by the social situation. They were poor. They were sick. They had no hope unless somebody came and stomped their enemies and made things better for them. I like the story of the farmer who, old-time farmer, sent his son off to ag school. And his son comes home from the first semester of ag school and he's learned a whole bunch of stuff. He wants to tell his dad all about it. And dad says, look, son, I don't have time for all that. It's time to plant the crops. I got to go away for 2 weeks. Here's what I want you to do. And I want you to obey my instructions to the letter. Okay? And the son says, yeah, dad. And so he tells him, plant the corn here and the peas here and the sorghum and the millet. And the son, as soon as his dad leaves, gets out his books and his soil test kit and everything. He goes around. He checks everything. He goes, wow, dad's a pretty smart guy. That is the best place to plant the corn. And that is the best place to plant the peas. Dad got everything right except this one little plot over here. I'm going to plant corn instead of millet. And when his dad gets home, he walks the fields with him. And the dad says, son, there's one little problem here. You didn't obey my instructions. Oh, yes, I did, Dad. I planted this where you said, and this where you said, and this where you said. It's just this one little thing that I did different, and here's why. See. And Dad says, no, son, you didn't obey any of my instructions. You did exactly what you wanted to do everywhere on this farm. It just so happened that 90% of it agreed with me. And see, Jesus has this whole crowd of people following him. Or, as it says, traveling along with him wherever he went. But are they following him? Or do they just happen to be going the same place he's going for now? Perhaps some of each. And perhaps they won't know until they encounter some of these things, which it is that they are doing. Certainly his disciples, those nearest him, thought they'd thrown out everything and they were following him. But Jesus tells them this story too. I thought to myself, it's kind of silly. You know, I mean, you tell your kids, anybody who wants to come with me to Walmart, needs to be dressed and in the car in 10 minutes. And sure enough, you're in the car. You wouldn't tell them again while you're in the car. Anybody who wants to go with me to Walmart should be dressed and ready to go in 10 minutes because they're in the car. You're on the way. Well, Jesus' disciples are there with him. They're on the way. Why is he telling them, if you want to be my disciple, they are his disciples. But that decision is made again every day. And if your kid gets out of the car halfway between here and Walmart, guess what? He's not going to show up in Walmart with you. And Jesus knew that it was entirely possible for his current disciples and the entire crowd following him to get out of the car before they got to Walmart. That's what the parable of the banquet is about, isn't it? Here these people said, we're coming. But when the time came, I'm sorry, it would cost too much for me to leave my duties here and come to the banquet. Please excuse me. Now, it seems ridiculous. It's a party. But Jesus points out over here, well, the reality of the situation is it may be very difficult to drop what you're doing and come to the party. If what you're doing is your family, your loved ones, your own life, it may not look like it did in the parable of the banquet, where the excuses were awfully flimsy. It may not look that way. But the reality is that no matter how hard I try, I cannot keep from being separated from my family or my own life. There was a missionary who was killed in South America by the people he was trying to reach, by the name of Elliot, who said, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." He may not have known those words were so prophetic when he said them, but it certainly became true in his life. So Jesus is not trying to discourage them from following him. He is giving them a warning, though, that it's going to be awfully tough. And he is saying, "I think that I'm worth it." But how do we know that Jesus is really worth it? And I'm going to focus you in just on what we've read here. Just what we've read, verses 25 through 27. And I'd like you to discuss with your friends and enemies, we won't leave anyone out, near you, and if they're not very near you, you may need to reshuffle so they're near enough to communicate with. I'd like you to discuss what there is in these few short words that could help us understand why it is worth it. Jesus says he's worth it. What has he told us in just this little section that if we understand it in perhaps the larger context, what we know now, would help us understand why it is worth it? What is the good news in these few verses? A lot of bad news. It's going to be hard. It's going to be tough. What is the good news? Go ahead, and if you need to shuffle yourself a little bit and discuss with the people next to you, what is the good news in here? What insight can we get just from these few verses into why Jesus is worth it? All right, who has seen some good news? I don't see any flapping wings yet. Paul's about to be raptured, but he's always about to be raptured. Yeah, I just wanted you to look at these three verses and tell me what you see in there that explains why it's worth it. Jesus is basically saying, I think twice about this. This is awfully hard. You're going to have to give this up and give this up and give this up. And I'm just saying, I think there's another layer in here that properly understood helps us see why it's worth it. You need some more time, or is anybody ready to respond to that question? This is a challenging question. That's a very interesting statement. Are you willing to pay the price? What did you say? The cost, yes, sorry. Wow. Now, what in those verses brought that to mind? To just even sort of come back around to communicating again. And but the part that really intrigued me, did anybody else catch what she said? Are you willing to pay the cost like he paid?
Well, she hadn't paid yet.
Or had he? He had already left his family, his home. He didn't have to do that. Now, he hadn't fully paid. He hadn't fully even been separated. You know, I mean, that happened at the cross where he was completely separated from his father and mother and brothers and sisters. And but he'd already left. And he already was on the road to his own execution. When Peter tried to tell him, oh no, this will never happen to you, he said, get behind me. I'm going there. Karina?
He said basically what I was going to say. He's on the road. But, yeah, I mean, that's what we know he was, because that's his whole attitude. He was carrying the cross, even though he wasn't physically at that moment, because of the way he was able to speak to the Pharisees and the way he was able to speak.
Interesting, yeah. He knew that it was making them so mad that they wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
And that they could do it.
He was creating the situation for himself to die daily.
Yeah.
So he was carrying the cross daily. In that sense. Very real.
Wow.
That led to the cross, to the actual cross. Anyway.
Anyone else have something to add to this? Thank you, Jane. It's my pleasure. Ken?
When I think of a disciple, I think of you can't be a disciple of someone unless you're at their feet, mm-hmm. dwelling on everything they're saying.
Yeah, that's what it meant.
And all that.
Yeah.
And Christ is saying, if you're going to be my disciple, these are things you're going to have to deal with.
Yeah, but why is that true? In light of what you just said. Sorry, I don't mean to derail your train of thought. But
we're following him around. We're following him around and eating, getting healed, mm-hmm. seeing the show, seeing the
It was a party. Yeah.
And Christ is not running him off. He's just saying there's way more to that's going on than just me feeding you. There is a cross. There is a cross.
Yes. And if you're going to sit at my feet and absorb everything that I do and everything that I am, this is who I am, and this is where I'm going. But he isn't saying, and if you prove yourself worthy by doing these things, then you can be my disciple. He's saying, and I'm going ahead of you in all these things. And if you want to come with me to the good place I'm going, then you're going to face these things with me. How did Jesus hate his own life? You understand that phrase? Jesus hated his life if it meant that you and I would not be part of it. He didn't want that life. And he wasn't willing to keep going on living it, if by giving it up, he could have us with him. He wasn't willing to keep his family if it meant that you and I would be on the outside. He wasn't willing to keep his dignity to stop people from spitting on him or beating him to a pulp if it meant that you and I would not be part of his future. This is the story that he's telling here about himself when he says it's going to cost you everything. But he says, I'm willing to pay it if it means we can be together. I'd hate to see you miss out. It's going to be worth it. Now, Jesus could have kept his life, right? He could have kept his family. He could have kept his dignity. But he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. I can't keep my dignity, let alone my family or my life. They're all going to slip out of my grasp. How foolish it would be to cling to them and lose something that could never be taken from me. When Jesus died, was that the end of the story? He went into the tomb, rested a day. And then he opened the back door and walked out. And so if I'm following him, I may face all of the things that he faced and have to give up all the things he gave up. But when I get to the grave, there's a door out the other side. And what I receive there can't be taken away. It's worth it, Jesus said. It's worth it because I have gone ahead of you. And because it was worth it to me to pay that price. So what might a life look like if I thought of myself as already dead? On my way to my own execution. It was really interesting. As we were talking about this, Karina told me a story when she was at Rio Lindo Academy. All along our life pathway, we have decision moments. If I want to be a follower of Jesus, I will have to make this sacrifice. She came into the cafeteria, sat down, noticed none of the other kids who come in here and sit down are praying before they eat. Should I pray before I eat? Maybe I'll be embarrassed. Now, there's no commandment. Nowhere in the Bible does it say you have to pray before you eat. Karina could have rationalized it in many different ways. Well, people will think I'm holier than them, and they'll, you know, I don't want to turn them off. She had to decide. Am I going to do something that will be a small death to me in order to follow Jesus? This is what I would naturally normally do, unless everybody's watching and not doing it themselves. And she said it was no big deal. You know, it wasn't like someone was threatening my life if I prayed or anything. You know, it'd be maybe just people might snicker a little bit, or probably everyone would ignore it, but they'd say, oh, well, Karina, ooh, she's religious. But I said, yes, but how many of your fellow students who came into that place and under the pressure chose not to pray? For how many of them was that a decision that took them on a path away from God? We don't know. Small little decision. Preserving my dignity changes the trajectory of my life one way or the other. So I can't tell you what it would look like for you to consider yourself on your way to your own execution. You'll be faced with situations, incidents, every day in which you decide, is it worth it to me to follow Jesus in this situation? And over the course of a life, those decisions set a direction. And when the direction is well set one way or the other, very hard to turn a whole ship very quickly. Most of you here probably have, by your life decisions, already set quite a pattern. Real blessing in that, isn't it? Things that other people agonize over, you don't even think about. You know, you return your tithe at the beginning of the month, you write out the check or whatever, you don't think about, oh, am I going to do this time or not? Tremendous blessing in a pattern, a life of following Jesus. Jesus says, stop and consider now. Is it worth it to you? There will come a time when you will be faced again with an intense, heavy decision somewhere. And the direction you set in your life now makes all the difference when you get to that point, which way you will turn. Any other comments, reactions, convictions?
Okay. I look forward to being Jesus' close disciple in heaven, listening to his words and feeling his love.
If he's this brilliant off the pages of a book, what's he going to be like in person?